In case you all want to know more, Anne Lamott just came out with a new book, Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy, and the event will be around that book. Well, this is a tremendous pleasure for me to be here with you. I like to wander, so sorry for some of you in the front. It can be annoying. But when Walt asked me if I would do this, I said yes right away, right? Though today's task is incredible, to cover American Christianity in one 45-minute period. Next week's a little bit easier. We're going to be talking about Pentecostalism, so that's a little bit more manageable. But I'm going to be real upfront that, you know, you have to take a particular lens on such a huge time period. And so my lens is going to reflect the research that I've spent 20 plus years mostly rummaging around, as Tim is well familiar, and Kent, rummaging around in old archives from Los Angeles all the way across the country to Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. I'll introduce you to a Roman Catholic woman that I found there. But just to help me manage it and to help us keep track, my lens is going to be Protestantism primarily, though I'm going to hopefully tell you something about Roman Catholicism that you might not know. Women, not only is that my research area, but I am an ordained clergywoman, not in the pioneers time, but certainly early on when I was in seminary, we had no full-time female faculty members. That was 80 to 83 at Duke Divinity School. And I still remember a very southern gentleman coming up to me. You know, I came right out of seminary to, or right out of college to seminary. I was 22. And he looked at me and said, "Now what are you going to do when some drunk man shows up on your parsonage at midnight?" Well, how do I answer that? I'm still trying to figure that out. I'm going to end today to talk a little bit about just the walk towards ordination in United Methodism in particular. Also evangelism. I taught evangelism for 7 years at Duke. I was the first evangelism professor there. It's also a keen interest of mine. So we'll be getting around men and all kinds of things, but that is my lens for today. I know you're going to meet some people that you've never heard of before, and that's what's fun for me. I'm going to see if Tim has heard of some of these too. So with that, let's start. Now, I know that this teaching time that you're doing now started with the Protestant Reformation, right? How many of you remember what Walt taught? I know that was like September, right? You're like my students. But as you know, the Protestant Reformation was the time when I like to think about it as sort of the hegemony of the Roman Catholic Church really began to splinter. And a lot of it was theological, but a lot of it was also political, in that countries wanted, rulers wanted to control the church. And we're going to start with King Henry. Now, we all say that he wanted to form the Church of England because of a divorce, right? Well, that's only partly true. He wanted to control the church, yes, so that the church would grant him the divorce. But the reality was you had the church in Rome determining what's going on in England. And someone like King Henry isn't going to like that. You also had a church that was functioning in Latin, whereas in England, they're speaking a different language. And so with the Reformation, it's political, it's theological, it's socioeconomic. So when King Henry establishes the Church of England, he's still basically functioning liturgically as a Roman Catholic, right? So that's why there's so much similarity between the Church of England, even the Anglican tradition, Episcopalian tradition in our country, and Roman Catholicism. There's a lot of overlap in the liturgy. So it's not surprising that the Church of England looks pretty Catholic, one would say, right? Well, with the Protestant Reformation, you've got more and more people wanting to get back to what they consider basic Christianity. I mean, one of the things, the horrible things that the Reformers did was they took these beautiful churches and chapels and broke stained glass and threw down altars, and all in their attempt to purify Christianity and to get back to primitive Christianity, which they thought was simpler and less ornate. So there was a group of many people, Protestants, actually in England at the time, we're getting to America in just a minute, England at the time, who felt that the Church of England was too corrupt. So here you had the Reformation and the Church of England formed, and then you had people who thought the Church of England was too corrupt, and so they formed their own associations. Is this there? And those are the people that we know of as the Pilgrims, or the term the Puritans. And they found the Church of England too stuffy, too ornate, too highbrow, and so to find religious freedom, they came over to this new land. And so you have this great migration where 20,000 plus Puritans cross the water to establish a new way, not just of being church. One of the things about the Puritans, if you don't know already, is that like John Calvin, they wanted this to be their whole life. You know, Calvin in Geneva wanted to establish a holy government, school system. It was all encompassing. And the Puritans, who have some affinities with Calvinism, particularly with the doctrine of predestination, wanted the same thing. And so they came to what we know now as America. And one of the people who led this group was John Winthrop, and was the leader of the Puritans who founded the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630, and was their first governor. And he's the one who coined the phrase, the city on a hill. And it comes from his sermon preached while they were traveling across the water. And he says, "For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of all the people are upon us." And this should begin to resonate with some of our thinking even today of like American exceptionalism, that God has blessed America to be a Christian nation, to be a nation on a hill and its light shines. And this is, I'm not going to get into politics, but you can see where this, well, we are in politics, but where this has fueled a lot of thinking in American Christianity and American politics. But what's interesting, what I think we forget, is that Winthrop looks at this kind of negatively. In other words, if we don't act as this city on a hill shining forth, then God will judge us. And he goes on, "The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. We shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God's worthy servants, and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us till we be consumed out of the good land whither we are going." So it's a two-edged sword. You know, there's the blessing if this new land, this new venture, goes well and God is truly blessed, and then there is, of course, the other side, the curse, if it doesn't go well. So the Puritans, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time here, but again, their whole point was to establish a Bible commonwealth so that it permeated everything that the Puritans were about, and where obedience to God's word was preeminent. And they based the laws of the Massachusetts Bay Colony as much as possible on biblical precepts, and towns were organized with the place of worship in the center of the town. And as you know from visiting, probably most of you, New England, the towns are still set up that way. Now, again, in contrast to the Church of England, where basically you were born into membership, again, the Puritans are trying to do something different. And so they set in place that church membership is restricted to visible saints whose conversions give evidence that they are among the elect. And this is where you begin to see predestination. I know you talked about George Whitefield. We're going to talk about him just a little bit, because if most of you, like I am, are Wesleyan, predestination is not part of our theological vocabulary. But basically, they believed that God's elect would show forth their election by their conversion and the way they lived their life. Okay? But, oh, not the but yet, sorry. Prospective members were to give testimony of their conversion in order to become members, and for men, a voting role in the colony's public life. So you see again that religion spilled over into everything that the Puritans were about. Here comes the but. But what about the second and third generation? Right? It's always the question. Parents want to raise their children in the faith and expect children to follow after, but as we all know, doesn't always happen. Okay? Puritans found the same thing. So the parents, the grandparents come over with fervor. We're going to establish this religious colony. We're going to be a city on a hill, and our children are going to flock to the church. Yeah. Doesn't always happen as planned. So this is really interesting because in 1662, so they're coming over. Winthrop establishes the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630. So basically 30 years later, if you want to call that a generation, depends on how long people lived, already they're recognizing that the next generation is not as fervent as the initial generation. And so they make amends, they make this decision to extend what they call a halfway covenant to, and they extend baptism to the unregenerate grandchildren, in other words, those who haven't experienced their own conversion yet, of church members. And so what they're trying to do is to keep children and grandchildren within the fold, whether or not they've experienced their own conversion. Does this make sense? Okay, it's a very interesting question. And when I was pastoring, it was, I had to wrestle with whether someone who grew up in the church and just happened to be back and wanted to baptize their child, even though, you know, they had long left the church, what do you do? And it's that same question. And so the Puritans, 30 years later, are already recognizing that this is an issue. And so they extend church membership. Now remember, we just saw that they were expecting visible saints and giving evidence of conversion. And now, 30 years later, they're extending baptism to children and grandchildren. And the compromise, as you see, is to keep as many people within the Puritan fold. And there's a lot, this is, as you can imagine, there's a lot of pushback about this, but this is the decision that was made. Now, you doing okay? All right. By the way, if there's something that you want to ask or something that you don't understand or I'm going too fast, I have a tendency to talk quickly. Yeah. It was by the public testimony. Yeah, yeah. So you had to stand up in front of the congregation and give or write out a conversion narrative, which is really, it's an incredible source of archival information of these conversion narratives. And there's been a lot of interesting work comparing male and female narratives, conversion narratives from this time. Well, I mean, they also, you're going to see in a minute, they had a church church trials, in a sense. They would have to come up in front of the ministers. And so they had I mean, that's what you remember, the stocks. You know, if you've been to New England, they had their own forms of punishment. Retributive justice. How about that? Okay. Now, very interesting, and this I wish we could spend the rest of the time on. So we often bemoan the fact that today, so many more women in the church, right? What's going wrong? This has been proven historically that after 1660, women noticeably outnumbered men in the church. So experience nothing new, right? And I would love to sit and talk about this, but it does explain why, as an historian, I see sort of every generation there is a push for men in the church. And it often is equated with masculinity, and there's a push like the Men in Religion Forward movement in 1911, 1912, more recently Promise Keepers. Even out in Seattle, Washington, where I came from, there were more conservative fundamentalist churches who would sponsor cage fighting in their churches. Anything to get men in the pews. Please don't start that, by the way. I know Highland Park has a lot of money, but please don't build a cage. Walt's ready to go, right? The question is, do you fight in your ministerial alb or not? Like Willow Creek, you know, the big mega church. When Bill Hybels founded it, he targeted men between 18 and 40. Because, again, that is a population that is not as numerous. And they knew that if you got the men there, the family would come. So the reason I say this is because I hear a lot about this, and I'm a very strong feminist, so I hear a lot about how feminism has destroyed the church and la 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 la. And I just, as an historian, I just want you to know that women in numerically is nothing new, but what's interesting with the church is that women haven't been in leadership until recently. And so that's kind of where, but I could talk about that the rest of the time, and I won't. Okay, so as Puritanism is kind of waning, as new movements do, one of the ways to look at the history of America is as revival movements move across the country, and that's kind of where what's in the back of my mind with what we're doing. So Puritanism is on the wane, and then I would say God brings revival. And a lot of this period of history is known as the First Great Awakening. And again, you can't pinpoint these, as it started August 5th, 1730, and it ended, you know, December 29th, 1750. These things take time to build momentum, and then they take time to kind of die out. But there was what seems to be a movement of the spirit in places like Massachusetts. Solomon Stoddard, who was actually the grandfather of Jonathan Edwards, is thought of as kind of the first revivalist preacher. But there are these series of religious revivals across New England, and they're partly fueled by George Whitefield, and Walt said that you've already studied him a little bit. So Whitefield comes over. He's 26 years old. He's known as a grand itinerant. And he just storms across the New England colonies. So he's here for less than a year. Well, yeah, much less than a year. 45 days. He's preaching more than 175 sermons. So I once had this figured out. It's about 3+ a day. Right. Well, again, this is before microphones, you know, and he's preaching, going from place to place. And as you see, great crowds are coming to hear him. He's very famous. People fall to their death from the balcony because they're all crowded in to hear him. And his last meeting is held on Boston Commons. Someone needs to write a religious history of Boston Commons. we're going to see another person who preached on Boston Commons. And at to that point, that was the largest crowd that had gathered. So as seems to be the way, itinerant evangelists like Billy Graham, we're going to see Billy Sunday, other people come in and kind of help to fuel these flames of revival. And that's what Whitfield did. Though the person who is most noted for his influence on the First Great Awakening was a Congregational minister known as Jonathan Edwards. He's also known as the father of American theology. He was the first American to write really systematized theologies. Brilliant pastor. As I said, he took over from his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, actually pastored his church in Northfield, Massachusetts. You've probably heard of Edwards. Did you talk about Edwards at all? Okay, so you know his most famous sermon, right? Yeah, you got it. Sinners in the hand of an angry God. And what's interesting is that that's what we know about him, right? When he was preaching this, people interrupted him many times before he finished the sermon, moaning and crying out, "What shall I do to be saved?" He's known for that, but he's also did a lot with the religious affections. He did a lot with the Holy Spirit. Just a brilliant, brilliant man. And I need to keep moving on. So he is one of the main preachers in the First Great Awakening. Now, what happens with revivals, and this is one of my main points today, is what happens with revivals when the Spirit is unleashed is that unexpected people begin to feel the Spirit and respond, okay? One of the people that I don't think maybe any of you have heard of is, her name is Bathsheba Kingsley. And around, she is part of Edwards' congregation. In October of 1741 in Westfield, Massachusetts, Bathsheba Kingsley is brought up in front of the church council on charges. Here she's guilty of, quote, stealing a horse and riding away on the Sabbath without her husband's consent. Now, why did she do that? Why did she do that? Because God told her to. One of the really interesting things that I study a lot is how women are empowered by dreams, visions, the words from God that says, go do this. I have called you to preach. And despite the fact that it goes against the male order of the church, they go. And Bathsheba went. And you see, to justify herself, she explained she had been obeying the will of God. She received immediate revelations from heaven. Well, how can you argue with that? You can't, though they did. Okay, so in the words of the church council, quote, she had almost wholly cast off that modesty, shamefacedness, and sobriety and meekness that all are to characterize women, right? So she's acting as a woman shouldn't. She's acting as a man, right? And she's gone quite out of her place. And so they chastise her. The problem is, too, that you see that her husband's been beating her. You see that instead of obeying her husband, who tried to control her with hard words and blows. So you get in this little glimpse, you get a real look at what, you know, is going on kind of behind the scenes. So you've got a woman and the husband can't control her because she's obeying God, not him. And I will say the women I write on throughout the generations, this is a lot of what that God's called them and who's going to stand in their way. So 2 years later, she's still doing it. And Jonathan Edwards gets in and they eventually tell her to desist and so forth. But that's just a little glimpse we have of what happens when the revival comes. Another glimpse that we have is that the First Great Awakening had a tremendous impact on releasing the gifts of preaching and all works in all sorts of ways for African Americans. Now, I'm not going to rehearse the history of slavery, but this is still in the early to mid 1700s. And so here you have women and men who, again, step out of their servile position because the Spirit has come upon them. And it's hard for us to grasp the power of conversion for people who haven't been given a place at the table. In fact, the place at the table has been prescribed in awful ways by other people. But what we see in the First Great Awakening is that African Americans really begin to step up and preach and so forth. And one of the women that you'll see a little bit later was Amanda Berry Smith. And you see here, she said, "I passed through many sorrows, many trials. Satan has buffeted me, but never from that day have I had a question in regard to my conversion. God helped me, and he settled it once and for all. The witness of God's Spirit to my conversion has been what has held me amid all the storms of temptation and trial that I have passed through." So again, it's that power of conversion that changes people, despite their physical circumstances, to become heralds of God's word. Another one that you'll know is Harriet Tubman. She gives, she puts it all on her conversion for the dangers and trials and tribulations that she faced every time she brought someone along the Underground Railroad. So I want you to see it's not just for preaching. I'm not minimizing that. It's not preaching only, but it's also works of liberation like Harriet Tubman engaged in. Okay. So also at this time, we're now kind of turning to the beginning of the 1800s. And you know, our country is marching westward. And the image that you need to keep with you is there are not white clapboard churches when people came, like to my state in Ohio, founded in 1803. You know, this is the wilderness. There aren't churches there. There aren't streets. There is nothing, at least in terms of the settlers coming forward. There's been a whole culture, Native American culture there. But in terms of what we're talking about today, and so church really happened around camp meetings. And when you think camp meetings, think literally tents or wagons circled up around a creek where there's water, maybe a clearing in the forest. But this was a big social time. I mean, you're out on the frontier. Big social time for people to get together. It's also a very heightened time for religious experience. Camp meetings are really quintessentially evangelistic, revivalistic. Their whole purpose was to bring people together, get them excited, whip them up with good preaching and singing, so that if they weren't converted, they would be soon. And just to give you to give you an example, I'm going to read a description. The most famous camp meeting took place in Cane Ridge, Kentucky, in 1801. And just imagine this. Again, how many people are there in, you know, Kentucky at this point? This is Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, are my home area. And over a week-long span, anywhere from 10,000 to 25,000 people are gathered in a forest clearing. There's actually, you can visit Cane Ridge today. It just has this pull in terms of American Christianity. Now, I'm going to read you a description of an eyewitness from this camp meeting. I want you to keep it in mind when we turn to Pentecostalism next week, okay? Because I would guarantee that you probably don't associate what you're about to hear with quote-unquote normal Protestantism, okay? But I would argue the camp meetings were not normal Protestantism as we think of it, okay? "At times, the slain in the spirit," and the slain, those are just people who fall down in the spirit. At times, the slain in the spirit numbered into the hundreds and had to be dragged aside and laid in neat rows to prevent their being trodden underfoot by ecstatic multitudes. Some lay motionless so long that doctors bled them to revive them, with the result that the ground was crowded with bleeding bodies like a battlefield. Others experienced violent spasms in which they jerked their heads rapidly from side to side or whipped their bodies forward and backward with such force that kerchiefs and hairpins, I love that bit, flew from the heads of the women. Still others danced or ran or rolled or erupted in fits of laughing and barking and ecstatic moaning. Okay? Just keep that in mind for next week. Ecclesiastes was right. There is nothing new under the sun. So I want you to see the camp meeting as a time where, in a sense, normal society, or what was kind of the culture of the day, the hierarchy, was set aside. And in this freedom, children testified. We have accounts of children being converted and standing up on a tree stump to preach. These were oftentimes integrated meetings, again, pretty remarkable. And this was a place where a lot of women got their start preaching, teaching, singing, and something we don't talk about a lot, exhorting. And I just want to spend a minute. I got to speed up. I've got 15 minutes left, and I don't know how many slides. Exhorting was a time when, after the minister preached generally his sermon based on a biblical text, then an exhorter came up and gave the emotional appeal. It's the time where the exhorter would say, okay, you've heard it. Now is the time for you to decide. Don't wait for tomorrow, and would often recount their own testimony. And this was a time where a lot of women got their start, because they weren't preaching, they were exhorting. And that is, for instance, Amanda Berry Smith. I read a quote from her before. Amanda Berry Smith was one who got her start in through exhortation. She was also an incredible singer. She also was an incredible preacher in the Methodist Episcopal Church and in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and a leader in what's called the Wesleyan Holiness Movement. So I want you to see, though, how camp meetings, yes. Well, that's what I just gave the definition. It's the person who comes up after the preacher and gives the emotional appeal. And a lot of conversions were traced to the exhorter. And these were often women, as I said. Okay, so, we can skip that. Okay, so the first great awakening has died out. Camp meetings are going, but we have, went too far. Beginning kind of roughly the early 1800s and the camp meetings, then Charles Finney, who is a lawyer, converted at age 29, comes on the scene, and he, like Jonathan Edwards, becomes a catalyst for yet another round of religious revivals. This is primarily in upstate New York. There were a lot of revivals came through upstate New York, and there's a wonderful book written called The Burned Over District, because there was a group of Mormons that came through, and the Second Great Awakening, and you get the image that these fires of revival sort of burned out the district. But Finney was known as a tremendous evangelist, and he introduced a lot what they call new measures in his revivals. One was he would set up, before he began to preach, an anxious bench, where people would come when they felt under conviction. They would move either during the sermon, or he'd invite them afterwards to come. And then he and other exhorters, would work with these people to bring them on to conversion. He also popularized what was called the protracted meeting, which went on for several days or weeks. And most interesting for me is that he encouraged women to pray and speak in mixed assemblies, mixed as in male-female. And so again, Finney had recognize the power of women's prayers, women's speaking, and so forth. The other thing I want to mention about Finney is that he believed that revival and reform, or what we would call social justice, went hand in hand. And he went on to be the first professor of theology at Oberlin College, again in my home state of Ohio, North Ohio. And Oberlin, I don't know if you know about it, but under Finney's influence of conjoining revival and reform, it was the first coeducational college. It was a station on the Underground Railroad, and African-American students were admitted from the beginning. And again, this is not even the mid-1850s. And what I love about Finney is we think of evangelism and revivalism as being tremendously conservative. But Finney saw revival and social justice for all as going hand in hand. And I think in that way, he is really a challenge, I think, for many of us. Okay. How many of you have heard of Dwight Moody? Are you staying awake on me? Yeah? Okay. So with each generation, there's a new evangelist, right? And Moody, what his contribution was to organize revivals. So we've had them going on in camp meetings. We've had Finney traveling around. But Moody really brought business and religion, or business and revival, together. And he is really the one, and Billy Graham still follows the pattern of going to a big city, getting all of the kind of the big churches behind him, working, you know, a year or so in advance, getting the big choir, bringing lots and lots of people together from a city. One of his biggest revivals was in Chicago during the World's Fair in the 1890s, 1894, I think. Anyway, yeah, Kent, three, sorry, off by a year, darn it. But he was very, very much wanting, he worked ecumenically and wanted a non-denominational setting where people would feel at home. And as you know, music and revivalism goes together. His big songster was Ira Sankey, who was in a way as popular as Moody. And Sankey had such songs as Rescue the Perishing and Safe in the Arms of Jesus. This leads us to the opening hymn that you sang. Did anyone notice who wrote that? Fanny Crosby, who was also an incredible composer. She became blind thanks to a botched poultices are. It ruined her sight when she was 2 or 3 years old. And she wrote, I think it was, whoops, not there yet. She wrote more than 8,000 gospel hymns, including the one we sang, and we're going to end with one, Rescue the Perishing, Jesus Keep Me Near the Cross, and a lot of these were sung at a Moody Sankey revival. And we'll move on to Billy Sunday, who was, now he's the epitome of someone who pushed masculinity, because he was a former baseball player, played for the Chicago White Sox, whatever they were called. And you can see in his, he had this amazing athletic way of speaking. And I'm going to ask, what was funny? What did I say? Oh, athletic. Okay, we actually have a 1 minute video of his preaching. Next slide. Whoops, I went too far. There you go. Okay. It's only a minute, so you got to listen hard.
Civilization and society rests on morals, morals rest on religion. Religion rests on the Bible and faith in God and in Jesus Christ. The Bible doesn't condemn any man because of his wealth. The Bible says the man that don't provide for his family is worse than an infidel. No. According to our standard of gold and silver, Abraham was worth $1.5 billion. David was worth $3 billion. Solomon was worth $5 billion. Solomon could have hired Andrew Carnegie for a butler, J. Pierpont Morgan to cut his lawn, and Andrew Mellon for a chauffeur, and John D. to black his boots. America needs a tidal wave of the old-time religion. America needs to be taken down to God's bathhouse and the hose turned on her. And the time isn't far distant when the wheels of God's judgment are going to go sweeping through this old God-hating world. And I want to take a pledge in this audience to join me in a pledge that you will never rest until this old God-hating, Christ-hating, whiskey-soaked, Sabbath-breaking, blaspheming, infidel, bootlegging old world is bound to the cross of Jesus Christ by the golden chains of love.
You see what I mean? Billy Sunday was that his evangelistic organization was listed in like the top five. Whoops, where does, oh, can we get back to the, top five in terms of businesses in the United States. Yes. Billy Sunday, William Sunday. Yes. Yes, it was. Okay, can we get back to the, well, I'm glad you enjoyed that, right? Okay. I'm going to keep going. Okay. So I've been talking only about American Protestantism, right? But I want you to know that Roman Catholicism also had their own revivals. We don't think about Catholicism as really evangelistic. But again, it's coming to America as a new denomination, a new church, right? And so they're also needing to spread the word. And in the 1858, Isaac Hecker, who was a convert, late convert to Catholicism, founded the Paulist Order, which was a preaching order, and they held preaching missions, also very similar to Protestants. And one of the women, here we are, Martha Moore Avery, she's the one that I studied in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Now, you gotta love her hat. Yeah. We could talk a long time about what that hat looks like, but we're not going to. Needless to say, she made it. She was a milliner before, very interesting story. If you want to read her, I've got a chapter written on her. But the reason I show her is, again, I don't think probably many of you will have heard of her. She was a late convert to Catholicism, and she actually was an itinerant evangelist. She in and her compatriot, David Goldstein, who was a convert to Catholicism from Judaism, founded the Catholic Truth Guild in 1917. And they traveled around New England, particularly in the summers. I wish I had this in color, but of course that's before color photography. That is painted in the papal colors of yellow and white. It has on the front a little flag. At night, they put up a lighted crucifix. On this side, there is a quote from George Washington. It's an interesting, like Sunday, like Billy Sunday, who really combined patriotism with his message, they're very much Catholics or patriots. So 1917, there's a lot of anti-immigration, sounds like today, coming in. A lot of Catholics are coming in, and there's this move, just as we have today, to we want to keep America, America. We don't like these new people coming in. They're Catholic, they're coming from Southern Europe, who knows what they're bringing. And in the midst of this, Avery takes it on the road. She's sanctioned by Archbishop William O'Connell of Boston, and they want to convert people not only to Christianity, but to Catholicism. It's a fascinating story that I wish I could tell you more about. Another unexpected source of revivalism are child evangelists. In the 1920s and 30s, Utley's actually a little earlier than that, there were child evangelists in the United States and in Canada. Many of them were trained at Amy Semple McPherson. We're going to talk about her next week, her Angelus Temple in Los Angeles. But Aldine Utley has, again, a fascinating story. She, at the height of her popularity, she had a four-week campaign at Madison Square Garden in New York, three sermons a day, and she was 14, 15, 16, something like that. Again, one of my books, I start out with her story. The tragedy about Utley is, as you know, often with the child evangelists, they're very popular when they're young. Oh my goodness, how could they do that? Well, then she grew up into a woman. And then she really got people angry at her because she was a woman preaching. And it's a long story. She spent 50 or 60 years of her life in an insane asylum because of the toll. Again, this was not an easy life. People didn't go into this to make money, to become popular. They went into this because they believed God called them. Maybe they misheard God. I'm not one to judge. But that's why they came. So I think I need to end here, right? All I was going to do was to talk to you a little bit about kind of the march of women in ministry. The first woman ordained in the United States was in 1853, Antoinette Brown in the Congregational Church. And I'll end with our ordination, Methodist Episcopal Church in 1924 ordained women as local preachers, but it wasn't until 1956, 2 years before I was born, that Maud Jensen was the first woman in the Methodist Church. Now, she looks like a real feminist, doesn't she? I'm joking. I can't imagine someone who looks more like a mild-mannered woman. But I'm going to end it there. I was going to end it here with the first woman who was ordained, consecrated a bishop in the United Methodist Church. So, actually, this has been very quick. I know I've only hit the highlights, but I hope that something of what I've said has sparked some interest. More than anything, I wanted you to meet some figures that you knew about, but also some that you don't. Because this is what I think is fascinating about history, that it's always more than the people who get the fame and not so much the fortune, but the fame. So I'd love to have you back here next week. We're going to talk about Pentecostalism, get a look at the theological reasons, why it got started, and then we'll look at some of the leaders and trace it on through the charismatic movement, third wave, and into today. So thank you so much. Oh, no. I hate that picture.